Hey, thanks for joining me. Today, I'm talking with Patty Alper. She's the author of Teach to Work. You're going to love this. This is all about creating mentorships through business in schools. Stay tuned.
You are listening to Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12, a podcast for educators. Helping you help kids achieve their dreams. And now here's Steve with this week's show.
Patty Alper is president of the Alper Portfolio Group, a marketing and consulting company, and is a board member of both the Network for Teaching Entrepreneurship, NFTE, and US 2020, the White House initiative to build mentorship in STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math careers. She has been appointed to the Corporate Committee for Million Women Mentors. Through her services on the National Board of NFTE, Patty's vision served as the groundwork for the Adopt a Class program she founded in 2001. During her years of service at NFTE, she invited countless business leaders to join her in a mentoring capacity, helping teachers across the country inspire and coach entrepreneurship students on their business plans. Prior to joining NFTE, Patty spent 5 years working with incarcerated, runaway, and suicidal youth in Iowa's youth detention system. She also served as a counselor to psychotic adolescents at Chestnut Lodge, a long-term psychiatric hospital in Maryland. Say hi to everyone, Patty.
Hello, everybody. I'm thrilled to be here, and nice to meet you, Steve.
It's nice meeting you, too, and I appreciate you joining me today. And before we talk about Teach to Work, your book, could you tell us a little bit about any lessons you learned from working with the youth in Iowa's youth detention system?
Absolutely. First of all, Iowa is very rural and in the Midwest. I am on the East Coast now, so the kids are a little different. I work with all kinds of they were murderers and rapists, and it was a locked up setting, and they were held there till they went to court. So it was a new experience for me. I was just out of college, but I learned things about them and about myself. I learned that I have an ability to talk to kids at their level. I learned that I have to be patient and sort of let them come to me and be forthcoming in their own time. And I learned about myself that I'm pretty good at building trust. And no matter what kids have done, that they want to connect, that they want a safe place to connect and to be heard. So that was the beginning of sort of building a kind of career in communications for me, learning about skills on both sides.
That's interesting, because I know as a former teacher and administrator and building principal and such, that one of the things that you discover with kids is that they, no matter if they're the ones that cause you issues or they don't, they all want to be able to connect and feel some sort of relationship and rapport development. And it sounds like even the youth that are locked up, like you had that, that was part of what you found out.
Absolutely.
Tell me a little bit about, was that something that you sought to do? You said one day, this is what I want to go do?
Well, I thought I wanted to possibly go into psychology. So I went down that route for about 5 years, kind of playing along with, do I like this or not? And as it turns out, I veered toward business. I didn't love being locked away in both the psychotic setting and in the prison setting. And I also kind of wanted to be more productive and help kids on an upward bend as opposed to when they were at the bottom, so to speak. So, it was a path that I veered away from, but I still learned a lot of skills from it that I still kind of employ today, if that makes sense.
Oh, it makes a lot of sense. Especially in somewhat we'll get into in just a little bit. And that's something that's quite interesting what you're talking about. Because you're trying to pull them back from whatever edge they've gotten to, I would think, and and whatever baggage they've developed, it would be great if you could start the other before it ever happened. I would think that that would kind of be one of those epiphanies that would happen in working in that environment.
Exactly. And that's sort of where I've led myself to now. I'd rather be on the sort of almost the education and skills side of catching them before they kind of go south.
Yeah, excellent. Let's shift gears here. Let's talk a little bit about during your bio. I talked about how I talked about your involvement with the Network for Teaching Entrepreneurship, NFTE. Can you tell us more about the network, what it's all about, and what it your involvement and such?
Yeah, I need to give you a little more history of how I came to be there. Some of the details of my history get glossed over a little. So I actually built a construction company. I was an entrepreneur myself. And so I left the incarcerated world and went into the construction world. And one of the things that I did in that life, I wrote about 150-page strategic plan on how to build, how to understand your audiences, how to listen, but I applied it to business. And this is something else you don't know. I'm sorry, there are a lot of details in here. I had a radio show for a little while.
Cool.
And I ultimately interviewed a student from Nifty on my radio show. And this kid, 14 years old, African American, I want to tell you about this conversation. It was a Thanksgiving call, and she was talking about how she had a business and how she had a goal. And she had $4,000 already saved in mutual funds, and she was making stained glass windows. And I said to myself, you know, I'm going to push back a little on her and like, okay, what's the real deal behind this story? That's too good. So I asked her, when do you make these windows? Where do you sell them? How do you organize your time? What's the detail behind it? Well, she blew me away. She comes home from school every day. She does her homework first thing. And on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, she makes her stained glass windows. They're about 10 by 12. They're a little larger than a piece of paper. And at holidays, she makes them in different kinds of colors and packages them. And she has a sales team that goes out on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. She has a sister. She has girlfriends. So she had this path. And her goal was to go to community college. And ultimately, she wanted to open a design store where she sold arts and crafts products. So she had a plan. And as I mentioned, my construction building of the company, the piece of it that mattered the most for me was my plan. I knew where I was going. I knew my plot on how to get there. And that's still with me today. That was an epiphany that kids don't really often know how to do things, how to set a plan in motion, how to have an idea, have an implementation plan, how to craft who's this going to go to, what's it going to cost, a plan. So that is what I loved about the Network for Teaching Entrepreneurship. So I stepped up and I got on the board. And ultimately, what led me to this mentoring role was Nifty, and I still sit on the national board, as you mentioned. They come into communities and they train teachers how to teach entrepreneurship. And they have an award-winning curriculum. It's a wonderful organization. And I thought, geez, I went through 12 years of building this company and we did landmark business. It was amazing. It was right during the technology boom and we were automated and highly professional and college educated, jacket and tie project managers. It was a kind of a new form construction. And I thought, damn, maybe I could have something to offer outside, adjunct to a teacher and the book. Wouldn't kids like to hear from someone who's done it? And so ultimately, I stepped off the board. I became a guinea pig to create a role for a mentor to come in and not disrupt the classroom, but to add value to those kids who had to write a business plan. Each kid had their own idea, but they had to craft a plan. And ultimately, I helped them launch a company. I helped them take their plan and make it real, like take a product or service to market. So at the end of the day, they had a true accomplishment. They were turning a profit. They knew how to speak in a whole new business language, and they could stand up and defend the whole year-long experience. So it was phenomenal. It's an amazing experience. And that's the basis of the book. Because ultimately, I said to myself, okay, I can bring business people to do this. The other business people can come coach on business plans. But wait a minute, we have enormous amounts, a treasure trove of skilled professionals in America, both retirees, corporations, businesses, who have so much knowledge. Why aren't we tapping into that? So the book is a huge extension with Nifty's blessing to say, why can't an Intel engineer or a IT professional or a scientist also have a role? So I'm sorry, I went off. There you go.
That's okay. That's
sorry,
awesome.
Steve.
No, that's awesome, Patty. That's very cool, because that gives a lot of understanding to that, because what I like is that you've had this incredible experience where you're working with youth who are, you know, have all this just very serious baggage and they're locked up. And then you shift and you go and you start a construction company, and then you're able to, with Nifty, you're able to kind of touch into this world of being able to help kids, thanks to the talking to this young person on your radio show, and provide something for them to help them. And I think that's so cool.
And it's skills-based. I mean, if you think about learning, it's really fun to learn by doing. And sometimes it can be more meaningful if you're learning some of the time from someone who's done it before. So it's very complementary to what they're learning in the classroom. Like in the Nifty program, they might be learning cost of goods and market strategies, but now they're applying it. And I have to tell you this too, Steve. This is very important. This impacted me. The foreword of my book was written by Brandon Busteed. He is the head of education and workforce development for Gallup. And after I had my experiences for all these years, it's 18 years now, mentoring kids in entrepreneurship, the arc of the experience I witnessed from a student in September to the student in June was so phenomenal in growth and in confidence. And then I read this research paper by Brandon Busteed called Great Jobs, Great Lives. And the whole purpose of his study was to question, how do we best prepare students to succeed in a work world? And he came away, this is a very short answer to a very long study. It was the largest representative study of its kind, 3 years, 1 million interviewees. Students are twice as likely to be successful if they are offered these experiences while in school. One, to have the one-on-one attention of an adult to foster goals and dreams. And he says that can be a professor or a mentor. And two, apply your learning through a long-term project and or through an internship, that you're doing what you're learning. So I was like, I couldn't believe I was reading this because I was living it. So that just, okay, that sealed the deal for me. I had to go write about this because I was this is a prescriptive of how to do that.
Oh, that's awesome. And it just gives such a, you hear that passion that developed in pursuing this. And so so it's going to be a nice little segue into talking a little bit more about the book. The book is called Teach to Work, How a Mentor, a Mentee, and a Project Can Close the Skills Gap in America. And so just kind of for a second, who's the primary audience for your book and why should they read it?
Well, you know, and that's what I had to go through when the publishers asked me, who is your audience? And well, I have two answers. The first answer is this. I wrote the book in my mind's eye to an Intel engineer. I wrote it to somebody who has an enormous amount of knowledge, but may not have the best people skills. And there's no reason that engineer couldn't be a mentor too. That's in my heart, I believe that. So ultimately, the book has four audiences. It would be written, let's say, to Intel, the corporation that dispatches out mentors. Like, why do companies do this? And this is a prescriptive to any mentor that they send out, like that the engineer that works there. It is written to educators to say, you know, there is a world of business people that want to help you and that could have a role. If you want to read and learn about that, they're there. It is written to individuals. There's 78 million baby boomers who are starting to retire. In the book, I interviewed 3M. I interviewed five huge corporations. 3M in particular has a robust, what they might call an ambassadors program for people retiring, but still want a foot in 3M, but want to stay within their knowledge base. So this does that. It keeps that retiree connected to 3M, but going out and sharing manufacturing, development, industrial design with kids. So it sort of brings, it's a bigger, much bigger picture than just meets the eye. And the other audience would be nonprofits, because often they're the middle, like Nifty. They're the middle entity sometimes between business and education. Does that make sense?
Oh, it makes perfect sense. And just as a note, I want to, because you're talking to someone who, as a former teacher, I was a high school history teacher for a long time. And then I was I'm a former school administrator. I was a high school principal for a long time. And, you know, one of the things that you constantly did, and that's why I appreciate this, because your book's divided into two parts. You have why mentor and how to mentor. And so what's interesting about it is that it's also first of all, I want to say this, it's easy to read and understand your point, which is awesome. And the and as an educator who's looking to try and figure out how to connect and so forth to reach out, it also getting back to one of your audiences being educators, it really would help. Yeah, you know, I would have loved to have had this book as I'm talking, giving me fuel as I'm talking to some of the corporations in my area who thought that oh no, here comes that principal. He's going to ask us for money. And I wasn't going to ask him for money. I'm like, I want to talk to you about working with our kids and figuring out different ways you can send people over here. And you a lot of times what I ran into is you ran into people who kind of were short-sighted. If they didn't have one person in their building who's like, I have an idea how we could make this work. You kind of felt like you were trying to sell them, a bridge in Brooklyn or something. And a lot of times they just, it fade away fast. And so I love the concept of the book because it's all about helping them understand why they want to and then how to do it. And, a little bit later, we're going to get into this chapter where you talk a little bit about the developing rapport and the rules of engagement chapter where you get into this whole idea about the domain of the teacher and stuff. But I think this is I so see those audiences and I having experienced some of the other side of it, I can see where educators would totally benefit from being able to have this how-to book.
So So Steve, I so appreciate your saying that. When I tried to craft this role that I was just describing, that I for a mentor that wouldn't intervene with the teacher's teaching, but would add value to a student, I did that with business people in mind because I am a business person. So part of my role in developing the program for NIFTY and then more broadly to any professional is I was essentially a broker between two sectors. So I understand the business sector and I understand what makes them tick. And here's the deal. They want to know what you want them to do. What is my job? Give me a job description. Give me a beginning, middle, and an end. Not this ambiguous thing. Tell me what it is you want me to do and I'll do it. So that's what this is. That's how the project kind of begins to fit in. And then just because I try to listen and connect, I've worked now with probably 10 or 12 teachers in classrooms over the course of time. And, you know, you listen. First, they might be a little threatened by having this strange person come in. But that's why I wrote those chapters, is how do you create that dialogue and that safe space with a teacher and respect their classroom and their domain. And honestly, my mentoring doesn't even happen in the classroom. The teacher assigns me students. It is project-based, so there's always a project. That's really important, and I guess we'll talk about that. But then I leave. I go to the library. We have an office. I'm not in the classroom. She sends or he sends me students every 30, 40 minutes for a couple hours, and I go maybe twice a month. So I see maybe 10 students multiple times over the year, if that makes sense.
Well, that makes perfect sense.
So I'm not interrupting the teacher. He gets to teach their class, and I'm just helping a student on an assigned project.
That is so awesome. And that comes out in the book. And it, you know, and one of the things I want to do is I want to take a look at a couple of the chapters. And
sure.
And the first one, I love the title of it, and I just want you to explain where you're coming from, especially now knowing your business background. Giving Corporations a Soul is the short version of the title. Tell me what you're getting at.
Well, first of all, I took that from the mouth of Howard Schultz. I sat in an interview. I observed him being interviewed by the New York Times at the Aspen Institute. And that was the sort of takeaway for him, that he believes, and this is sort of a message to CEOs, that how you give is how you live. It sort of expresses your values. And as he said, a company can't just be there when the wind is good. It's got to be there when it's still and when the chips are down. So I love shining a light on companies that are doing this amazing work. And I've learned so much. I mean, I've given a lot of talks and written a lot of articles about why do companies mentor? Because I want to showcase them. I just did a feature blog on Accenture, who has spent hundreds of millions of dollars since 2011 in developing a mentoring program through 16 nonprofits that all work with schools. So they have a middle agencies. But the reason they're doing it is because they are not finding applicants that have the skills they need. And that's a big message. So they're stepping up and they are teaching coding and they are teaching kids the kinds of different roles that Accenture has for them. So they're trying to create a pathway. And just as an aside, this is like companies with a soul. Many of the, first of all, the millennials don't want to work for a company that doesn't do some good in the world. It's a big criteria. When the company sends a mentor out to a school, that mentor comes back not only with new management skills and new confidence and a new ability to communicate and be patient and talk simply. They're looked up to. You know, they are sort of a leader to these kids in some form. So it's management training. But they come back to the company enlightened and happier to be there. There's a greater sense of loyalty to the company for having done that. And they wouldn't necessarily have carved out that experience for themselves. They're grateful to the company for having allowed them to do that. So all those things, all those reasons give the company a soul to the community and to their employee public and to the school.
That's excellent. The it's interesting because that concept of a soul, because I think too often companies can become, you know, they're almost like billboards. You just kind of drive by them, and they kind of drive by the community they're in, and you're kind of helping them not be that.
Exactly.
So let's take a look at some more stuff. You know, at the beginning of chapter 3, a student's lifeline. Let me try that one again. At the beginning of chapter 3, which is a student's lifeline, you say, you know, mentors hold a unique power to transform a student's life. Talk about why someone should want to be a mentor.
Well, every human being is going to be different. I'll give you two answers from my personal experience. The first is that I actually study theology. And what first brought me to this, like before that little girl that I interviewed, is Maimonides. Maimonides talked about a hierarchy of giving. And he would say in the 12th century that the highest form of giving is to teach self-sufficiency, to teach somebody how to live on their own. So to me, there's no higher, I agree with that, there's no higher reward, great joy. Actually, Harvard did a study on people who mentor, and they concluded that they're three times happier than people who don't. But I want to read you a couple of excerpts from one letter, if I may be so bold. This
sure.
is one letter from one kid. Now, it's something I required in the program I designed, that at the end of the year, students should write a letter to their mentors. So I have this circuitous way of getting feedback that I think teachers should have the same thing. But this one blew me away, and I'll just highlight a few pieces of it. Today, there are rare occasions when you find people of such high standards willing to visit and teach high school students and enjoy it, especially at a predominantly African-American school where we are looked down upon with stereotypes and chosen to fail. What makes you different is that you wanted and cared about us differing from our surroundings. With your encouragement, I have walked away with the knowledge of running a business, which I was completely unaware of in the beginning. I feel completely gifted to be able to work in your presence. There is no physical or mental way to repay you. And thanks to you, I have found a whole other view of the world and the kindness of strangers. From the bottom of my heart, thank you.
That's cool. That is so, so cool. Go ahead.
That's why I keep coming back. I mean, that is it. There's no bigger return on investment than that. And, you know, I just actually gave a talk about this. If you dive a little deeper into this letter, she look at her self-image. She thinks she's destined to failure. That's what she said about herself, her self-narrative. And then look at this. She's walked away with the idea of a skill and a promise for her future. That's big. And then the other big thing that really resonated for me is she had a whole other view of a different world. Like, I'm a stranger. I look different than her. I sound different than her. But she had a whole other view. I think it's because I look different than she does. So people that don't look like her are, in fact, okay. Those are huge takeaways, I believe. So I know in my heart I'm doing a good thing. I know it's a good thing.
It is so awesome. It is a good thing. And, you know, what's really cool is that what you're tapping into there is exactly why people who do it for the right reasons, why people teach. Because when you're working with kids, the magic that can be developed as you see the light bulb go on, or as they start thinking about themselves or the world differently, or they start developing a plan about what they want to do and they had no plan before, and just all the different things that make you go, this is cool, because you're able to make a change, you're able to make a difference, you're able to help somebody in their journey on that path of life. And as trite or dorky that might sound, that's what's cool right there. That's it. That's that magic potion that people try and bottle, and you've tapped into it. I think that's so cool.
Thank you, Steve. Can I add to it real quick?
Sure.
So I believe that this mentoring role is unique. And I'm going to give you a few reasons why. And this is like going inside that relationship and what makes it not a teacher and not a parent. And I'll just do it quickly. There's six of them. But the first one is, if I did it, if I made it through my difficulties and bumps in the road, I know you can too. By being there and sharing and being accessible like that, that's a message you're conveying to that kid. It's different than a teacher. The next one is, I'm here to help. You can count on me and I'll be back. So it's not a one-time visit, and you're showing reliability, and you're showing a student that you'll be there. Three, through working on a project together and giving direction, in essence, you're saying, here's how. Now you try. So for the student, that's sort of the beginnings of skill development, whether it's writing a plan or developing a strategy or working out a timeline. And four, you might ask these thought-provoking questions and play a devil's advocate. For the student, it's a new kind of an adult dialogue. It's a respectful give and take. Five, and this is something I say to every student before when I first sit down with them, and this is huge. I'm not your judge. I'm not grading you. I'm not your boss. I'm not your teacher. I'm not your parent. I'm a new kind of adult relationship for you. You could call me a consultant around your ideas. But the most important thing is, and I say this to each student, you can reject my suggestions. You don't have to do anything I say, because this is your project. So for the student, they're learning collaboration. They're learning a gentle kind of an accountability. And they're having to take ownership. I'm giving up that authority completely. And that's different for a kid. They're not used to adult relationships like that. And I wanted to say that on this show, because you have a lot of educators, and there's room for all of this, I believe.
Oh, I think so. I think you're right.
And the very last one, and then I'll shut up. The last one is, by just listening, your very behavior says to your mentee, you are important. I want to hear what you have to say. And that gesture gives a student self-esteem. And with that comes motivation. Just that somebody's going to listen. So those are six big takeaways that I think mentorship brings to a uniqueness to a student.
Oh, that's those are awesome. And just in there, there's a little bit of a theme, which is why I asked the question at the beginning about maybe the things that impacted you from working with the detention youth, because it just, I wonder how many of them, there were no adults. The only lessons taught to them by adults were lessons of, I'm not going to be there for you, and anything I tell you is a lie because I'll follow it up by not following anything up that I say. And so they get used to those types of lessons. And then to be able to put it, adults in a, who, you know, they're not their, teacher. They're not their disciplinarian. They're not their, parent. They have something to share with them, and to have to, be able to make that connection and start seeing, you know, from those, the perspective of those six items that you just listed for us. I think that's, it just speaks to the power of this, this activity, the way you've created this mentorship, I guess.
Well, the sort of the key, the secret sauce of it is the, what I have coined, I've trademarked this term, Steve. So when you say this, please think of me.
Okay.
Project-based mentoring. It's not rocket science. It's project-based learning, but you add a mentor to it. Project-based mentoring. The secret sauce is when you put a project in the middle of that relationship, all of a sudden, and you give that authority over to the kid. Now, the mentor has to be taught that. You know, this is your role. They have to have some training. That is the secret sauce, is that project in the middle. And it sort of fits for each sector. It fits for the business person because they understand projects. I think it's enormously important for students to begin to learn projects. The idea of coming up with critical thinking of, what do I see in the world that needs to be fixed? What do I want to work on? Whether it's, like, here's a great example, SAP. I did a blog on SAP. A teacher in an IT class assigned every student to create an app. And SAP sent their technologists in to help students actually launch the physical app. But it was the student's concept of who it would be addressing, what audience, what mattered to them. It could be a cyberbullying app. You know, it could be a LGBT app, whatever. It could be whatever they care about, but they have to institute it based on their experience in the world and how they see the world, what's missing in the world. So that's the kind of the concept of sort of applying an example of a business, a project, and a student at an intersection. That this project is the secret sauce.
That's cool.
That's what makes it all work.
That's cool, because that gives them something to work on, to strive for together.
Exactly.
So awesome.
So kind of how it works, where the mentor has vast experience in the project dimension and in the content, the student is the idea generator, the responsible party, and the driver of the activity. Together, they design a master plan. The mentor helps the student overcome obstacles that they're going to meet along the way. Might help them with timelines, like this might be a six-month project. Kids are terrible at that. So how do they plan? How do they review the outcomes? Maybe they didn't have returns on their investment like they thought. Maybe it didn't come out the way they thought. And then ultimately, and I know we're going to get to this a little bit, is the preparation and delivery of an oral defense. Okay, what was my experience? Give them 10 or 15 minutes to stand up and share what they learned and their process. So that kind of describes the role and how the project sits in the middle of a real experience. And at the end of the day, I'm sorry, this is my passion piece. Can you tell?
Yes. All is good.
At the end of the day, the student has an accomplishment. They can write about it in their resume. For me, my kids launched a company at age 14. You know, I had one kid sell 32,000 cookies by the time he was 16 years old.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, he's still doing it in business. He's still doing it.
Wow.
But they also can write it on their college applications. They've done something that's theirs. So I think it's good.
Oh, that is. It's so awesome. And you know, it's funny. I'm going to go ahead and talk about it since you brought it up just a second ago, you know, that whole art of presenting. You get into that in one of your later chapters in the book, turning students into teachers. One of the things that, you know, it's funny, as a history teacher, one of the things I used to do, and I also did this when I taught an after-school program to adults in a what at that time was called a community college, I would require presentations, all right, where I would give them tips on how to talk in front. And the whole idea is to get them up in front of people to talk in front of their classmates. And I give them pointers on getting better at it. And the reason why I had that was something that you just talked about a second ago. I probably not in high school, but as I went to college, I had to do some presentations and stuff. But the first real major presentation I ever had to do, I'm a second lieutenant in the Florida National Guard, and I'm getting ready to talk to an infantry general who's mad because I'm Signal Corps. My unit's in charge of all the communications, and he can't talk. His infantry soldiers can't talk and communicate with the field artillery and the air cav that's supporting them, and he wants to know why.
Why they can't talk.
Right, and we can't figure it out. There was a problem, and we were trying to figure it out, and it wasn't happening. And so he comes storming in to talk with me. Well, this is this major debriefing, by the way, because he greets me. You know, the first thing he does is he doesn't want to wait for the briefing. He comes in through. They had Jeeps at that time. He's riding in the Jeep, and he comes up. His driver pulls up, and he gets out of the vehicle. And just imagine whatever words you want to fill in the blank here that I can't say, and lots of creative ones and ears set on fire type thing. You know, that'll give you the right feeling. And right. I want to know who's in charge here. And I said, sir, that would be me. And, you know, and I'm all of very young. I'm probably 23 years old. I think I'm around in that range, 22. And he starts blah, 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 blah. And I said, you know, and it was funny because I said to him, sir, we're getting ready to, you know, I'll talk to you a little bit about what we know, but where we are, the short answer is we don't know why it's not working right. And we're figuring it out, you know, and it's funny because if something that important, I'm thinking, oh boy, my career's over with just as it started. Nice. <You know? laughs> And, you know, and to be able to have those opportunities way beforehand where you're working on a project, you're troubleshooting, you're coming up with answers, solutions, working on it from an entrepreneurial standpoint. And, you know, something that could end up turning into something like selling cookies forever or, you know, the continuation of a stained glass window project or, you know, whatever it is that a kid dreams up that whether they dreamed it up on their own or whether they helped, the mentor helped them develop this. You know, that is such a cool thing because then to have the opportunity to teach about it, to share with it and to talk about what they learned and, you know, what worked, what didn't, or that type of thing. So,
well, and think about in later life, just like your associate in the reserves, how many times do you need to be able to present your ideas in later life? I mean, you need to be able to ask a boss for a raise. You need to be able to present to a company that you want to raise money from, you know, if you're a fundraiser. You might need to talk to a board that you sit on about your findings. You may need to talk to your spouse. You know, you have to be able to talk. And being able to put together your ideas in a coherent fashion and build a case and have and stand behind it with facts is enormously valuable. Every single student, at the end of the year, we go around the room and ask them all, what were their takeaways? I mean, I have a litany of answers, but all of them said, I can't believe I did that. I can't believe I stood in front of all those people. And in our presentations, we would have, you know, people from the companies of the mentors. We would have a classroom of students, and sometimes we would have other teachers or principals. So there's a variety of audience members. And none of them could believe they did it. And they were so proud and beaming and kind of gained self-confidence that, yes, they did it. With a template, you know, with a PowerPoint. But, you know, they got through it quickly, and they won. They walked away having won. You know, I quote in this, the beginning of the chapter, Eric Liu, who wrote a beautiful book on mentorship also. And he says, I love this, we are all teachers. It is the core of our humanity. It is what life is all about, passing it on. We teach to be sure we have not lived in vain, and we teach to learn. So it is wonderful to allow the kids to be the teacher.
It is so awesome. It sure is. Before we wrap up, I want to get you to talk just a little bit about one of the things that you get into in your book is the idea of the mentor building rapport with a student and actually developing respect toward the teacher. You get into this in two sections, different sections. Can you talk a little bit about what some of the pitfalls are of a mentor if they're not careful in working with the student and teacher?
Well, always there can be, you know, kids are going to be kids. And I don't have all the answers. Look, I'm a business person writing this, but I researched. One of the people I interviewed for the book was Carol Dweck, who wrote Mindset. I interviewed other teachers. I interviewed adolescent social workers. And I pulled from other books. So, you know, I'm still writing to the Intel engineer, right? So what is empathy? And how do you mirror back what it is you've heard? And what are some of the sort of fallbacks? Like Carol Dweck often says, always praise the process. Remember that, you know, kids are going to have a hard time. They're going to get frustrated with how they're doing in a 6-month-long project, let's say. So like she would say, be sure to remember to praise their progress, or have them review, go back and remind them how much, get them talking about what they've done so far. Sort of tricks of the trade, baby steps for the mentor and baby steps for the mentee. Like, let's do this one little baby step at a time, and I'm here with you. So many sort of fallbacks can be used to deploy with the kid, as well as just being empathetic and sharing problems you face that were similar. So there's lots of sort of recourse to help out. And just being there is the biggest. For the teacher, I always open my relationship with a teacher at the very outset. I like to sit down, maybe even go to lunch, and kind of hear, tell them my experience and see if, you know, they would want me to help in any other creative ways that I hadn't thought of, or let's keep a dialogue open. I want to give them feedback on what I've learned about the students when I work with them one-on-one. So just creating a open sense of communication so that everyone's on the same page.
That's excellent. And just taking time to give some thoughts about this with the teacher and the student, I think, is important, because in both of them can create some funny situations that funny later, in the beginning, awkward. And
right.
I think giving some advice up front is an excellent thing. So how would someone go about starting a program like the book describes in their schools? How would they go about, if it's an educator going, I want to help make this happen in my school?
Well, the first thing is buy the book, right? The first thing is get the book. I've written a series of articles exactly on this subject for an organization. It's called Education Reimagined. I just finished a 3-part series. So I've done a lot of thinking about it. The first one is a school should have their sort of ducks in a row. And I would suggest to start with selecting a couple of teachers that have good public relations skills and that are already probably assigning projects in their classrooms. And that could be any field. It can be any field. It could be technology. It could be biology. And then you talk to businesses relating to that field. Start with what you have in place. What teachers fit who might be open to having a mentor? And start there. Then structurally, you need either A or B. You need an internal person or you need a nonprofit. So NIFTY functioned that way for, like, in the D.C. area, they're in probably 40 schools. So there are nonprofits already in the schools that court mentors and bring them in. But you can do it internally, and these are the jobs of that person. They go out and kind of identify mentors in the business community. This is my 2 cents. I believe mentors need to be trained. I think they need a day or a half a day to be sort of told what to expect. I, in fact, have a curriculum. I'm not a mentor trainer, but I hired a curriculum writer. So I have a curriculum that goes hand in hand with the book that is available for that. The book is a self-guided kind of tour of every chronological step of the experience for the mentor. But I think they need to learn before they go do it. 3, somebody needs to do background checks. 4, they need to place the mentor in a classroom. And lastly, they need to check in once in a while. So it's heavier upfront, courting, finding, setting it up. I have found in doing this with the NIFTY program that you place a mentor with a teacher and that relationship just spawns years. I have mentors that have come back year after year after year because they have made a great relationship with the teacher. They love working with the students. And so the work up front was just the beginning. The ball started rolling and then it kept going. It's always nice also to acknowledge mentors because they're giving their time. So I think it's nice to, I always have the students write a thank you. Like I have about 1,200 letters now.
Wow.
I have, my office is covered in books with student letters in them, and I love them. So that's kind of what it's about. I believe, I think it would be really good, this is like a fantasy, that educators might sort of do a listening tour. This is what I wrote in the article. In other words, there is a skills gap right now. And if I were calling on a company, this is what I would say. I would say, I want to invite you over for coffee. I want to have 6 to 8 of my neighboring businesses over. And in my invitation to them, I would say, we as educators need to learn about your employment needs. And I want to conduct a series of conversations so we can better understand where business is going and how technology is impacting you. And think about ways to better prepare our youth to meet your needs. We cannot do this without listening and hearing from you. And all of this is changing. So let's begin by just having a conversation. If you want to call it a teach to work conversation, that would be okay.
Nice.
So that's what I think it needs, dialogue between these two sectors. That's my goal.
I think it's awesome. I think it's a great way of starting it. The conversation idea is exactly it. You know, if you can bring people to the table and, you know, what's, you know, the thought, donuts or lunch can't hurt.
Exactly. But if you're going to invite them, you have to have your ducks in a row.
Yes.
So you have three classes in mind that they can go to, or five, and then you're sort of ready to place them with whom you know. It's not rocket science.
I love it. I love the whole concept of the book itself and what you're doing, the pursuit of this, because it's only going to pay off in positive dividends. And you know, the letters that you've received are an example of that, as kids start thinking about what the future holds for them, which is cool.
Thank you for getting it, Steve.
Well,
thank you for getting it, really. I can't tell you. It's like a salmon swimming upstream.
I can imagine. Well, if a listener would like to reach out to you, Patty, and learn more, what would be the best way?
So I have a website. It's teachtowork.com. Of course, they can buy the book. And if they want to reach out to me directly, they can just go on the website. There's a contact page, info@teachtowork.com. So I guess that would be the best way. I do some little bit of speaking around, and I've been doing a lot of writing articles. That's been my modus operandi lately.
Excellent. I will put links to the show notes, to your website, as well as the articles and such, as well as where if they want to get a copy of Teach to Work, where's the best place to find it?
So if it's just a one-off, they would go to Amazon or to Barnes & Noble. If anybody was interested in buying more, like it's mostly for mentors and probably for teachers to understand the mentoring role, they could call the publisher. Their name is Taylor and Francis. They're a division of Rutledge. So, they're based out of New York, Taylor and Francis.
Excellent. I'll find a link and put a link in the show notes for them as well. So very cool.
Awesome.
So I've got last two questions, which I like to ask my guests. So here we go. If you were given the chance to talk with 100 brand new teachers who haven't started teaching yet, what advice would you give them?
That's a hard one. I guess these were a few thoughts I had. I think first is life is about change. Nothing is static. So I think it's the same way I wanted to kind of have that listening tour with companies, because ultimately we're training kids to go to work somewhere. I would say the best thing is to learn how to keep up, learn how to anticipate need, and find out how you can help. I mean, kids need to know those things, to be aware of what's around them. Like that movie, Hidden Figures. You know how those women knew they were going to be extinct if they didn't keep learning. So you have to anticipate change and need. And the other thing I keep hearing is, and I believe it, is sort of know what you don't know. And it's okay to live in some of that ambiguity. It's okay. That's part of living and teaching that. What are we going to do if we don't know? How are we going to go about making a decision if we don't know? Because ambiguity is part of life too. It isn't always right and wrong, right?
Oh, that's awesome. That's I love that. That's that's one of those things. And in this world today, it's I'm thinking about when I was first starting out in teaching. You had to go find the book and look up the book and find out whatever the information was you're looking for. Now you've got shortcuts through the internet. And, you know, it's a little bit easier to help them teach themselves to be resilient. Just have to teach them to be, question what they find. But the,
that's true too.
But I love that though. I mean, the idea of that advice is right on there, because the world is, there are not. I mean, it's not about, this is definitely the you know, it's got to be done this way, or this is definitely, you know, it doesn't work this way. There's so much of it that's not that, which is so
cool. And living within that, not knowing, like you have, okay, instead of giving them an answer, it is, what would you do?
How
are you going to find out? It makes them have to take ownership of the course and the strategy, so to speak.
That's awesome, because that's what you want, is them start thinking about themselves and say, this is I have these thoughts. I can have these thoughts.
That's exactly. There you go.
Yeah, cool. So last question. Do you have a teacher in your past who made a difference in your life? If given a chance to say thank you, who would it be and what would you say?
Well, don't get mad at me, Steve. I have two.
All is good.
I had a theology professor in college named Dr. David Weddle. And I would say we used to go, he would invite 12 of us to his home. Like, I thought he was like, we were his disciples. There were 12 of us.
Nice.
And he would serve us sherry. I remember that. And we would talk so deep and for hours that it actually, I still study to this day. I come together with people and we study sort of history of thought. And I love that. I love kind of diving deep. So I attribute him with that. And the other, and both of these, I still do what it is they taught me. So that's why I mention them. I had a piano teacher. And I love, love music. And his name is Thew, short for Matthew Elliott. And we went through all the songbook, you know, the American songbook. I learned music I never knew before. And now it can't come on when I don't say thank you. Thank you. I can't hear anything. You know, songs nobody else in the world would know, I now know. And they bring me joy. So, you know, that's good. I'm very appreciative of that.
Oh,
so.
That's excellent. Thank you. And thank you for sharing. I appreciate it. It's been awesome talking with you today. I thank you so much. I thoroughly enjoyed hearing and learning about Teach to Work and the concepts and your passion behind the concept, which is so cool. I wish you the best in all you do. And thank you again for talking with us.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you for being such an awesome listener and questioner. And I'd like to question you, too.
Well, thanks, Patty. Appreciate that.
Okay. So, yeah.
Have a great day.
Thank you. You too.
Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is a proud member of the Education Podcast Network. Podcasts for educators, podcasts by educators. The opinions expressed on Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 are those of the guests and hosts. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is intended to share ideas, advice, and suggestions for classroom teachers and school administrators. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is produced for educational purposes. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll share it with your friends. Take care.